they want to make all the currency digital. You know, they want to have a cashless society. I mean, if you go over your carbon credit limit, for example, they can shut off your credit card and your debit card. You're given a monthly allowance of how much CO2 you're allowed to emit through how much you drive, what food you can eat. The Big Mac is causing global warming. It has a high carbon footprint. They use this as justification to regulate down the food industry. And insurance companies also are probably want to make profits. They will probably increase perceived risk rather than actual risk. They say climate change is killing people. Even if it were, it's not evident in the data. So the human condition has never been better than it is today. Actually, I heard a story recently. They said that trees are back. Arctic ice-free during the summer, periodically between 10,000 and 6,000 years ago. How did that happen? So why is it a crisis now, but it wasn't?
This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
And we're live. Chris Martz, welcome to the show. Big fan.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm happy we're able to do it. I was hoping we were going to be able to do it in person, but life gets in the way. We're doing it remotely. Like I was just saying, big fan of your work. Been following you on Twitter for a couple years, maybe a few years. I forget why I initially followed you. I think it was like to follow a storm or something a couple years ago. And you're a man after my own heart, a young youth on the front lines of fighting climate hysteria. This is a topic I've been very passionate about for years on this show, particularly because I work in the Bitcoin mining industry, and all the climate zealots attack Bitcoin mining for using too much energy and polluting the earth. And I thought it would be great to get you on as somebody who is fighting back against this nonsense. Not only that, but going through university to learn about meteorology and weather, particularly the climate. And so like with that in mind, like how'd you get into meteorology to start? And when did you begin to realize that a lot of the propaganda around climate change is just that, propaganda?
Thanks for having me again, Mark. Marty, it's great to be here. What's interesting about this question, it's one of my favorite questions that people ask me. And it's an interesting story. So when I always wanted to be an engineer. That's what I wanted to do. And then I kind of had when I took classes in high school, my teacher kind of turned me off from it. But I found interest in weather during the blizzard of 2016. It was on my birthday. We had like 36 inches of snow. And just before the blizzard, we had a record warm or near record warm December that year. It was December 2015. And I remember sitting in church on Christmas Eve for the candlelight service, and it was 75 degrees. And just from, I don't know, maybe it was the Christmas movies or just distorted perception of, you know, my memory, what I thought was the case. I always thought it was cold and snowy around Christmas. And it was never, we never had mild Christmases like this before. And I kind of was a little concerned about it. And then of course I got the blizzard after that. And then we had Hurricane Harvey in 2017. We had a bad hurricane season. And I thought that was unprecedented. I was never really a climate activist. I was more of a casual, I kind of just went along with what I was told by mainstream climate scientists, mainstream media, based on what my teachers told me in K-12 education. And it wasn't until just some of these doomsday predictions weren't really adding up, and I decided to look more into it. And I came across a guy by the name of Joe Pistorti. He's a meteorologist. He's been a meteorologist for over 40 years, and he worked at AccuWeather for over 30 years, and he's now in the private sector. The Joe Pistorti posts all sorts of weather history facts, hurricanes. He does what hurricane happened on what date and what year. And he was giving me a perspective, as well as Tony Heller on his YouTube channel, when I came across his channel and also his Twitter page. They gave me a perspective of extreme weather events and how it has been just as extreme in the past, if not more extreme in many cases, in terms of the weather than it is today. And once I realized that I wasn't being told the full story. It kind of, it got the wheels turning in my mind. I became really interested in it. Why wasn't I being told the full truth? Why was the media leaving out certain statistics, or why were they cherry picking starting dates on graphs? And I began to start questioning some of the things I was told. And I became so passionate about it and interested, I decided to pursue a meteorology degree. And I'm a senior this year, so I'll be graduating in May.
Congrats, pre-congrats grad.
Thank you.
What in your mind, like a big fan of Tony Heller, Real Climate Science, his channel, is particularly fascinating because he does an incredible job of diving into how the data is manipulated. And I think starting there, like with the hysteria, the doomsday predictions, and all the numbers that are thrown at people, when you look into it, whether it's Tony Heller, who does a really good job, or I've had Steve Coonan on the show a couple of years ago now, at this point, you dive into the data and you realize it's being completely manipulated. And so let's educate the listeners who may not be aware of how the data is manipulated and how the manipulated data is weaponized against the public.
So how do you want to attack this? Like what question would you ask me to kind of jump this?
Well, there's
a lot of things we could go.
Yeah. There's like 97 out of 100 climate scientists agree that we have cataclysmic climate change in front of us. And then there's just like the pure data manipulation of NOAA going back and either changing old data or manipulating old data up. And then another topic that I'm passionate about is the fact that we're collecting more data, particularly in city centers, which skews the data one way or another. So with all that in mind, I mean, there's many ways in which it's manipulated. So whatever you're most passionate about, maybe we start there and then.
All right. I can probably touch on all of those things. I think starting with the 97% consensus is probably a good start. So you always hear this claim that 97% of experts agree. Well, the first question that somebody should, and this is invoked anytime you have a discussion with a climate change alarmist or climate change activist, they say, well, you're wrong because 97% of experts agree. So the first question that I would ask in return to that is, what is it that 97% of experts agree on? It's a very ambiguous statement. Do 97% of climate scientists, and I'm going to use that term broadly, do they agree that the Earth is warming? Yeah, probably 100% of them agree with that. I mean, that data shows that. That's a fact. The planet has been warming for the last several decades. Of course, if you go back tens of millions of years, the planet's been cooling, but it depends on what time scale you look at. Do 97% of experts agree, or over 95%, let's say 95, do they agree that carbon dioxide emissions have increased? Well, yeah. Do they agree that mankind's fossil fuel combustion is the primary reason for that? Probably. But that 97% consensus does not tell you, if you use that statistic, it doesn't tell you how many scientists think climate change is a existential threat to humanity or life on Earth. It doesn't tell you, it doesn't mean that they all agree that warming is catastrophic. It just means that they agree that there is, at least in some capacity, global warming, and that there is an anthropogenic element to it, whether that's through fossil fuel combustion or urban heat island effects or land use change or a combination of all three. It's a very broad statement meant to put down debate and discourage it. But when you actually look at the nuts and bolts of this claim at 97, or sometimes they'll even say 99, or not 0.5% of experts agree. There's two studies that these come from. The 97% consensus statistic comes from comes from Cook et al. 2013, and that was published in the Academic Journal Environmental Research Letters. And in that study, they examined 11,944 climate abstracts. They looked at studies published between 1991 and 2011, over a 20-year period, and they read the abstract, just the very first part of the study, and they were all climate-related studies. And they looked at whether or not they endorsed anthropogenic global warming or not, or ascribed a cause to the warming over the last 100 years or 50 years. Now, 66.4% of those states had no position whatsoever on the cause or causes of climate change. So they just discarded over half the studies from their analysis, and they looked at the studies that did take a position on climate change causes. And of those remaining papers, 97.1% of them endorsed human-caused global warming. So if you actually do the statistics, you include the 66.4% of studies that the authors just completely, it was tossed aside, it's more like a 32.6% consensus from that academic paper alone. But again, this doesn't mean, and this isn't a scientific, this isn't a consensus of scientists, this is a scientific consensus. There's a difference. Consensus of scientists is just kind of opinion polling scientists. The AMS did that, the American Meteorological Society, and they found in a 2016 study that they did, a little over 50% to near 60% of members thought that all or most of the warming has been made. And a little over 50%, I think, said, I don't remember the exact number, they said that the warming has been primarily harmful. So that's nowhere near 97% of scientists agree from the AMS, the American Meteorological Society. But this Linus paper, it doesn't quantify, it doesn't tell you that warming's catastrophic. They just say that 97% of papers agree or endorse an anthropogenic global warming position. That's not actually, that doesn't mean it's catastrophic. The other study that they cite for this claim is the Linus et al. 2021 study, which they say, well, the consensus has grown. It's 99.5% consensus of scientists. Again, it's not an opinion polling of scientists. It's a survey of papers. So it's a scientific consensus, not a consensus of scientists. There's a difference. Either way, none of them are really give your argument credence. An argument is based on data and evidence, being able to present that. It's not based on consensus. That's political terminology. It's not science, but that's a whole other can of worms. But the point I want to make in that the Linus et al. 2021 study is that they did the same exact thing. They ignored a whole chunk of the studies. I don't remember the exact statistic off the top of my head. And they just looked at the studies that made a position of the climate studies and climate change studies that they looked at. They looked at studies that endorsed a position or the other without looking at the rest of the papers. They just tossed what was inconvenient to their narrative. So there's nowhere even close to a 97% consensus. When it comes to what scientists generally, if you were to just go around and ask a scientist in the field, whether that's oceanography or meteorology, atmospheric science, atmospheric chemistry, physics, mathematics, data science, the people that study climate, if you went and asked them what their positions were, there's a general agreement that global temperatures have risen since 1850 by about 1.2 degrees Celsius. There's obviously uncertainty in that, especially because the further back you go, the less reliable the global temperature record is. There's huge error bars. But that's kind of generally agreed upon. It's warmer now than it was during the end of the Little Ice Age. By how much? Yeah, who knows? But it's warmer. We know that from proxy data. We know that from a bunch of different sources. It's also widely agreed upon that carbon dioxide concentrations have increased by about 51% since the pre-industrial average. And it's agreed that fossil fuel and combustion, the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas is the primary cause for that. And there's agreement that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas due to its physical structure. It's not a homonuclear diatomic molecule like oxygen or nitrogen, which is why they're not able to intercept photons of infrared radiation and emit it back down. Carbon dioxide, like methane and water vapor, generates dipole moments, which allows it to absorb and emit infrared radiation. And it reduces the rate at which Earth cools to space. It doesn't trap, they say it's like alarmists say that it's heat trapping gases. That's not what they do. They don't trap heat. That means to physically prevent. It just reduces the rate of radiation loss. So the Earth cools slightly less because of their presence. So, and it's primarily water vapor. That's the big component here. So that's what's kind of agreed upon. What's not agreed upon is the most consequential things. Exactly how much of the warming has been man-made. And if all of it has been man-made, then how much is due to urbanization and land use change versus greenhouse gas emissions? We don't know. And the reason being because the biggest greenhouse gas signal should be warming in the tropical upper troposphere, about 300 millibars, the pressure level. that's not happening. Most of the warming is at the surface, which if you look at what climate models project versus observations, that should be, that's more of a signal of urban heat island effects. We also don't know if warming is a net benefit or a net drawback to humanity and our economy, the life and life on Earth in general. Generally, historically speaking, it's good, but too much warming would be bad, probably, just like too much cooling would be too bad. So we don't know whether global warming is good or bad. And if it's bad, we don't know what the best solution is to mitigate its impacts. So those are the biggest and the most consequential impacts or issues relating to climate change. There's a lot of dispute. There's no consensus on the most important facets of this issue.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com. Do you have an opinion on what the most important facet of this issue is?
Well, I agree that there's been man-made global warming to some extent. I mean, the physics of, you know, the laws of radiative transfer, thermodynamics, they all make sense. In theory, all else being equal, if you double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from any level, whether it's 4 parts per million, which we would all be dead if that was the case, or say that you double it from 400, which we're a little over 400 now, 423, double that to 800, 800 to 1600. So each doubling, it's kind of a logarithmic effect. It takes longer and longer to double concentrations. But each doubling of carbon dioxide, it enhances Earth's greenhouse effect, natural greenhouse effect, by about 1%. And that results by itself about a 7/10 of a degree Celsius global average temperature rise. That's not at all significant. And if it weren't for measurement, nobody would even know. Nobody would even know. It's not at all consequential. The difference is where you get these like rapid warming scenarios of like 2 to 4 degrees Celsius in the IPCC is because they tack on a bunch of positive feedback loops that amplify warming. But we know that negative feedback dominates. Even the mainstream scientists admit it. They just say it's slightly less negative.
Let's dive into that. What would a positive feedback loop and a negative feedback loop look like?
So a positive feedback loop is, say you, whatever the cause, you warm the Earth's temperature by a degree. What happens is you get a bunch of reactions. So you get, say, less snow cover. And snow, being like, you get heavy snow, a lot of snowpack or a lot of ice in the polar regions. Snow is, it's because it's white, it reflects radiation. It's a very good reflector of incoming solar radiation, like just like clouds are. So it would, you get less snow cover, you reduce the Earth's albedo. And that means Earth can't cool as efficiently, radiatively speaking. And so that amplifies the warming effect. Similarly, if Earth were to cool and you get more snow cover, more glacial ice, more sea ice covered, you would actually increase the cooling and it would be a positive feedback loop that amplifies the cooling. Negative feedback dampens effects. It kind of keeps Earth roughly around some sort of balance. The energy's budget's never in balance. There's always imbalances. This is the problem with climate change alarmists, that they think that the Earth's always in this delicate, balanced state. That's not the case. There's always energy imbalances, and that happens naturally without our input. But negative feedback dominates. If positive feedback dominated, Earth would have been a permanent hothouse or a ice box eons ago. Negative feedback dominates. So when you get a little temperature upward, a little rise in temperature, you get feedback mechanisms such as increased cloud cover, more evaporation, more cloud cover, and that reduces the incoming radiation from the sun. So you end up kind of trying to keep the temperature down instead of going up. And then the same thing can happen if you try and get the temperature down, you get positive feedback that, or not positive feedback, you get negative feedback that tries to reduce the cooling. So it keeps it around kind of a quasi-steady state for time periods on order of multi-decadal. Even geological time periods, we've been through ice ages, we've been through glacial cycles, we're currently in an interglacial period, still in an ice age, but interglacial period, but Earth goes, kind of just oscillates through these cycles because negative feedback dominates. We're not seeing these huge swings, which would be more of a characteristic of positive feedback that amplifies things. But these positive feedbacks, the climate models, they produce these rapid warming scenarios because they think they don't really account for clouds very well. They assume that you increase warming, you increase evaporation, so there's more water vapor. And water vapor being the most potent greenhouse gas, well, that warms, especially the polar regions where it's cold and dry the most. The problem with that assumption is that they don't look at clouds. And you increase evaporation, you increase the humidity, but you also increase cloud cover, so you reduce the radiation coming in. And clouds are very powerful, and they have significant impact on the global radiation. So if you increase cloud cover, you're actually going to cool the planet, or you're going to have a negative feedback that doesn't make it warm as much. This is why climate models produce too much warming. They have been observation show. That's what called the cloud thermostat hypothesis. It's something that Dr. William Gray, the late Dr. William Gray from Colorado State University, and also he has postulated, as well as Dr. Roy Spencer at University of Alabama Huntsville.
Well, this seems like something that, you know, particularly the cloud cover and the negative feedback loop that would materialize if something gets out of balance in one direction. It should be, it seems like a rudimentary fact of how climate actually works that these scientists should understand and factor into the models, which begs the question. I mean, we've seen this particularly in like pharma industry, economics industries, computer science as well, where we do have this misaligned incentive to produce papers that come to a certain conclusion due to who's giving out the funding for particular research. Does that exist in the climate world as well?
Absolutely. It's kind of more nuanced in how this works, in that when there's announcements for opportunities of research grants, funding agents, they'll post it on whatever website, whatever organization is funding this research. A lot of times it's the National Science Foundation. That's when those are taxpayer funded grants. They say government funded, but let's be honest, it's taxpayer funded. And so they'll announce an opportunity for scientists at academic institutions or the government, researchers, or anybody really, to apply for a grant. And so when you submit your, in these research proposals that these funding agents that they put out on their websites, they have very specific guidelines that you have to adhere to. So if they want you to investigate, for example, wildfires, the impact of greenhouse gas emissions on wildfire the impacts of anthropogenic climate change on wildfires in Mediterranean California, and they want you to look at how reducing greenhouse gas emissions should be a focal point of policy in reducing that disaster risk in the next few decades, or by 2100, they want you to adhere to that. They don't want you looking at, well, let's see how forest management is playing a role in this. Or maybe we could reduce risk by putting power lines underground or having better zoning codes. Maybe not building stuff in these forests where there are tinderbox. When you submit your proposal, you submit your form, you kind of have to outline why you want this grant, what your intentions are, why you think you should have this grant, what your data methods are going to be and how you're going to go about this research. You, obviously, you're not going to state your conclusion in the grant, but you're going to say, well, I'm going to look at this and that, and I'm going to do this method and that method. And then you submit it and they review it. And if they like your outline, which your proposal, you're likely to get the grant. So in the case of the example I provided, if you go in and you say, well, I don't necessarily want to look at how climate change is impacting wildfire activity or greenhouse gas emissions. I want to look at better, I want to look at forest management policies. I want to look at such as prescribed burns, you know, increasing those to reduce risk, increasing mechanical thinning to clear out underbrush, looking at better zoning codes and putting power lines underground. Because a lot of times toppled power lines and Santa, the high wind events, the Santa Ana winds, they topple power lines and they spark a fire. If you say that in your proposal, you're not likely to get funded because they want you to adhere to their guidelines. But if you state, on the other hand, well, okay, I'll look at, you know, what the importance of CO2 and reduce in emissions and why fire risk is increasing because of that, then you're likely to be funded. That's how this whole thing works. And a lot of times, I mean, there's very little research proposals out there. A lot of climate research now focuses on conveying catastrophic harm to the planet. They want you to think that the world's ending. They want you, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they want you to, climate research now focuses on impacts and primarily being negative. It doesn't focus on actually understanding what's going on, not the climate dynamics. There's some research that is conducted, but a lot of times it doesn't get published in the more prestigious academic journals like Nature or Science Magazine. It might be in some other open access journal and not one of the esteemed ones.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores. Connect your wallets or custodial accounts and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
Thinking of like burn control, like Australia, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, and they had those insane wildfires and they tried to blame it on climate change, but it was like, no, you stopped allowing controlled burns to happen like a decade ago, and you let all this underbrush build up, and yeah, of course you're gonna have insane wildfires. And that's,
yeah,
like
see the, this.
And it's happening in Canada too as well, right?
Yeah, it's happening primarily in the western, in western Canada, northwestern Canada, in the Rockies and the mountains, in the forests out in the west, and just western North America in general, California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Alberta, all those states and provinces. That's a big problem. It's also a problem in Australia, as you mentioned. Now, this isn't the case everywhere. Actually, if you actually look at global wildfire burn acreage, there's been reconstructions that have been done going back the last few centuries. Even with the recent increases, which are due to poor forest management, the fact that we've had fire suppression for so many decades actually has reduced fires to considerably from what they were in Western North America in the 1700s, 1800s, when we started adopting the fire suppression practices in the early 20th century, the U.S. Forest Service, the 100%, you know, you snuff out every fire that you see. It actually reduced fires for a long period of time, but eventually that has allowed forests to become overgrown. And a lot of when it gets during the dry season, during the summer, in California, for example, that's their dry season. And it doesn't take much for that stuff to dry out every year, whether they're in drought or not. It's just always dry. And when you get this accumulation of fuel, especially small diameter 1 to 10 hour fuels, that dry out very quickly when weather conditions change and be like on a dime, become highly flammable. There's been a huge increase about the forest floor, and that is a significant component to why we've had increased fires, because there's just all this dead stuff that's dry and laying on the forest floor because it wasn't burned through prescribed burning like the Native Americans used to do. And we don't have mechanical thinning of the forest. They just let the forest become overgrown. This is a big problem. We see this again in Australia as well. But generally speaking, if you go look at a global picture, even though there's regional increases in North America, Australia, a few other places, overall global fire activity has actually declined over the last 30, 40 years from satellite records. There's several studies that discuss this. The Mediterranean, they're down significantly. Europe, they're down significantly. Asia, they're down significantly. We don't see nearly as much wildfire as we did. The Copernicus ECMWF, they have an assimilation system where they calculate, they use satellite data since 2003 to calculate the global fire radiative power. And they look at the carbon dioxide emissions from wildfires. So higher CO2 emissions from fires generally means it has a very strong correlation with vegetation area burned. And last year was pretty high, but it wasn't the highest on record in the last 21 years. But it's actually declined quite significantly over the last two decades, believe it or not.
Yeah. And they have the gall to say that it's increasing in intensity and frequency. Not only that, things like hurricanes, which I'm pretty sure have been falling in severity and frequency over the last century. I'm not sure about typhoons. Obviously, there's just a big one in Asia, but would you consider them overt lies, or are they manipulating statistics in their favor, data in their favor when it comes to this? I mean, this is a lot of stuff that like Tony Heller dives into.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about, and that's actually a good question. With regard to hurricanes, the typhoons and hurricanes are the same thing. In the Northwest Pacific, they're just called typhoons. They're each basin, they're called something different. In the East Pacific, they're called hurricanes as well. Atlantic, they're called hurricanes. North Atlantic, South Atlantic, East Pacific, hurricanes. But West Pacific, they're called typhoons. And then the Australian region, I think they're called severe tropical cyclones or something like that. I get the names confused, but they are typhoons. It's the same thing. The same type of storm. If you look at the number, and this is from data from Colorado State University, Dr. Phil Klotzbach maintains this archive on the website. It's the Colorado State Department of Atmospheric Science. They have basin archives for each ocean basin going back to 1980. Now, her satellite era goes back to 1966, actually. But prior to 1980, there was limited coverage. It was spotty coverage in the Southern Hemisphere. And some of the intensity data estimated from cloud tops, the IR satellite images, all the beautiful colors you see, it's the IR, the temperature of the cloud tops, the browner, the redder it is, the higher the cloud tops are, the colder they are, the more, usually more intense, the more convection, the more intense the hurricane. So you can kind of estimate hurricane intensity from those observations. But prior to 1980, it's kind of spotty in the Southern Hemisphere, especially in the South Pacific, so in the South Indian Ocean. So you can't really get a full global picture going back to 1966. So 1980 is when we have really good adequate satellite coverage of tropical cyclone activity across the entire world. And if you look at the actual annual number of hurricane strength tropical cyclones since 1980, they have actually declined significantly, statistically speaking, over the last 40 years. And in fact, they reached an all-time record low count globally in 2021. So, man, there are more storms. Well, that's not happening. And you look at the number of major hurricanes, category 3 or higher, on the Saffir-Simpson wind scale. If you look at the hurricane, the equivalents in the other basins to that, there's been no trend. There's been no increase in major hurricanes since 1980. This is all from the Colorado State University website. This was actually discussed in Nuts and Not All 2019, a study published in the American Meteorological Society Journal, and then you had Klotzbeck et al. 2022, where they looked at this data since 1990, but they because of consistent observational practices with microwave sensors for some of the more short-lived named storms and weaker systems. They came to the same conclusion as what I'm saying right here. You can, anybody watching can go look this up themselves. But the IPCC, we get to the deception of statistics. In AR6, the sixth scientific assessment report, IPCC AR6 WG1, the physical science basis, in chapter 11, where they discuss these changes in meteorological extremes, what they state is that the proportion of major hurricanes have increased in the last 30, 40 years. They state this, and the way that they frame this is to be deceptive, to try and make you think that hurricanes are getting more extreme, but they're actually not. If you actually look at the data, which I just showed you, what I just told you, the number of major hurricanes are going down, or number of hurricanes total are going down. The major ones are staying steady. So if you set it up as a ratio of hurricanes to major hurricanes, well, the ratio of major hurricanes is increasing, even though total hurricanes have gone down, major hurricanes have remained constant. So if you set it up as a proportion, you can frame it in a very misleading way to suggest that hurricanes are becoming more intense. They're getting stronger because the proportion of major hurricanes has increased, but the actual number of them are not. The only reason that this trend exists is because total hurricanes are going down. Now, the other thing they say is that, well, hurricanes are rapidly intensifying, or with rapid intensification is where a tropical cyclone's maximum sustained wind speed increases by at least 35 knots within, or 35, at least 30 knots within, or 35 miles an hour within at least 24 hours. And the number of rapid intensification events globally have not changed since 1990, according to Klotzbeck et al. 2022. There was a record high in 2015. We had a very active typhoon season, so that was part of the reason for that. But overall, there's no trend in rapid intensification events in any basin.
Yeah, I was not aware of that proportion, and that is a classic manipulation of data to push a narrative. How much of this do you think is due to the fact that we just have better data around this, and the fact that we're more connected than we ever have been as a human society? We can actually see things that were maybe imperceptible to people in different parts of the world just decades ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a huge increase in the number of short-lived, less than 2-day named storms, tropical cyclones, tropical storms, less than 2-day named storms, the short-lived ones. There's been a pretty significant increase in every basin of those since 1980. And climate alarmists will always say, well, look, we're seeing more named storms now. The reasons for that, if you actually read Lancy et al. 2010, Knutson et al. 2019, and then you read, just look up any paper on this. They're going to tell you practically the same thing. Even I think the IPCC even mentions this. There's been improved microwave sensors and satellite equipped to satellites in the last few decades. So we're able to actually detect wind speeds and measure them better. We have more aircraft reconnaissance missions where you get the drop sons, like the hurricane hunters. They fly into the hurricanes and they drop these radio, kind of like radio sons on weather balloons, but they're drop sons. They drop them into the hurricane to measure wind speeds and stuff. So it's very interesting, but it's all due to the fact that there's just more technology. We've been able to have better detection. And also another factor for increased named storms that's often overlooked is that in 2002, NOAA decided that they would start classifying or naming subtropical cyclones. So they didn't name subtropical cyclones before 2002. So those aren't counted, and they didn't go back in the historical record and adjust for that. Any subtropical cyclone was not named back then, and they didn't go back and account for that. So they've always named tropical cyclones. They since 1950, around 1950, but they don't, even before then, they still count tropical cyclones. They don't count subtropical. So that also has factored in a kind of a step function increase in the number of these events. And you look at the Atlantic Ocean Basin, the North Atlantic, we have hurricane records going back to 1851. However, if you look at the seasonal track map, seasonal track maps from, say, 19, one of the most active, if not probably arguably the most active hurricane season in the Atlantic was 1933. But if you look at the seasonal track map, most of the storms are clustered in the Gulf or right off the Atlantic coast. You don't see a whole lot of the Cape Verde hurricanes coming off Africa or developing the Atlantic development region. You don't see a lot of out-to-sea storms. You just see a lot of close-to-land tracks, and a lot of them, but there was no satellites. And any storm that didn't pass by the quote-unquote observation ship-based observation network, it would have been missed in the historical record because nobody saw it. So prior to satellite data, we missed a lot of storms. But if you go back, if you look at the actual number of U.S. hurricane landfalls, this is a great metric. If you look at the number of U.S. hurricane landfalls, they've actually decreased over the last 175 years, slightly. So the decrease in hurricane strike fraction, but the increase in the number of hurricanes and named storms in the Atlantic over that same period just shows that we didn't have, well, we were able to detect the ones that were out to sea that were missed by ships or didn't hit land. And so Landsea et al., or Avecchi et al. 2021, which is co-authored by National Hurricane Center scientist Dr. Chris Landsea, who I am an acquaintance with, in the study, they homogenized hurricane counts going back to 1851. And if you account for those changes in observing platforms, rather, there's no trend. There's no trend in hurricane counts, and maybe even a slight decrease because of the decrease in U.S. hurricane strike fraction.
But they're getting worse, and they're going to destroy the planet. And then the other thing, too, like I come from an economics background, and the other data that they love to cite is the cumulative like dollar damage that's done, and they completely neglect the fact that these urban environments have been built up over the course of decades in the past of a lot of these major hurricanes, whether that's New Orleans, Miami, any other coastal city in the U.S., and they say, look at all the economic damage. It's going up. Insurance rates are going up. It's like, well, yes, because you've built large urban environments in the paths of a lot of these hurricanes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my favorite thing. And this kind of ties into the presidential debate last night, where they always have the climate change question. And Vice President Harris was asked about climate change. Now, thankfully, Trump didn't answer the question. They went on some other rambling because Trump, you know, he's great with a lot of things, you know, foreign policy, sure, economics, sure, but his science is very weak. And I think his intentions are probably in the right place, but he needs to be better informed with the statistics. And he said, clean air, clean water. We got to have clean water, right? Clean water. That's my Trump impression. And yes, I agree with that, but that's not really climate related. That's more environmental. If he was equipped with like me or some other, or Steve Coonan is a great example. Somebody like that, or Will Happer or Tony Heller or Roy Spence, Judith Curry, any one of these people could give him the stats on that. I think he'd be better prepared to answer a question. So thankfully he didn't have time to answer that question. They just kind of went on. But Harris regurgitated that, as we mentioned, the insurance industry propaganda. Well, we're seeing more insured losses and we have to raise insurance premiums on our homeowners policies and monthly deductibles. This is obviously evidence of climate change. I love this argument from climate alarmists because they think that the oil industry, the oil executives are evil and they're for profit and they're intentionally destroying the planet because they want to make record profits. They're in control of the gas prices. So they want to, increase their profits and at the expense of your dollar, making you suffer. But so they claim that corporations are evil, and all of a sudden, in these big companies, and all of a sudden, they're in bed with the insurance industry. They think the insurance industry is holier than thou, and that they have no incentive to want to raise premiums. Now, in a lot of cases, insurance companies, especially the smaller ones, have had to cancel homeowners insurance policies in certain states because of the fact that they're losing money. But that's due to a number of factors, such as inflation being, you know, and the cost of repairs. Your house gets damaged by a fallen tree from a severe windstorm, or you get storm surge damage from flooding from a hurricane, or you get hail damage on your solar farm, like we saw at that facility down in Texas and near Houston back in March, I think it was March or April. Yeah, if I'm an insurance company, I don't want to pay for that. It's going to cost me more. I'm going to be losing money, especially with the cost of repairing these things going up due to inflation. We also have increased, especially on the coastlines, we have increased coastal assets. We have more stuff that's in Mother Nature's path. A Category 5 hurricane hitting Miami Beach in 1926, we had a Cat 4 in 1926, actually. It was very devastating. And if you actually adjust for normalized damage, adjust for CPI, and you adjust for it changes in exposure due to displacement of wealth in the path. Actually, 1926 Miami hurricane is the costliest in U.S. history. But my point is that a Category 5 hurricane or 4 or 5 hurricane hitting Miami in the 1920s would be less devastating economically and with loss of life. Well, maybe not loss of life, but definitely economically than a Category 2 or 3 hurricane hitting Miami today, because there's just more stuff to destroy. The planes, just more stuff in the path of tornadoes. Tornadoes aren't getting more frequent or severe. In fact, the number of violent tornadoes are down 50% since 1954, when near real-time observing practices began in the Storm Prediction Center database. We just more stuff to destroy. It's not climate change. And insurance companies also are probably want to make profits. They want to make money too. So they will probably increase perceived risk rather than actual risk to buff up their profits a little bit. It's business. It's that they're the insurance industry. They're having to face climate change, and it's not really the case. There's just more assets that they have to cover. There's more stuff that they have insured properties in high risk regions, and they don't want to insure that necessarily. I can't blame them because they have to remain profitable, but they also use climate change as an excuse to raise premiums even higher.
It's either climate change or Haitian immigrants being imported into your city that are going to increase your insurance premiums. It's frustrating for me because I like to think of myself as a first principles thinker, and particularly for these ideas, and really didn't get dragged into it. I got dragged into it in college, actually, because I took a climate elective class and actually had like a professor who was like, the climate change stuff is all bullshit, and like walked us through a lot of this data. And I was like, oh shit. So I had that in the back of my mind, but then like getting into the Bitcoin mining industry and how demonized it's been over the last decade in North America, Canada first, and the United States more recently. It's just insane how confidently ignorant people talk about this stuff. And when it comes to the concept of cataclysmic climate change broadly, everybody is speaking out of their ass. If you actually dive into the data and the intricacies and understand how data is being manipulated and emotions are being catered to, and it is having a detrimental effect on the global economy, not just here in the United States. I mean, Germany is the perfect example. They fell hook, yep, line, and sinker for this at the turn of the century and wound down all their coal and nuclear power plants in favor of wind and solar. And now they're basically in a severe position of weakness as the war between Ukraine and Russia continues. And their politicians are positioning like they're doing something virtuous and good at the end of the day, but one can make a very strong argument that it's actually the exact opposite. What they're doing is detrimental to human flourishing and the quality of life overall for not only Germans, but Western Europeans specifically.
Absolutely. Yeah, the whole net zero, it's interesting because they claim that the whole idea, the whole climate crisis distinction revolves around the impact or supposed negative impact of man-made climate change on humans, on human civilization. And I'm trying to get my thoughts here. The whole definition, the whole premise of the climate crisis revolves around there being negative impacts to society and the overall state of human welfare. But if you look at the data, I mean, the number of the human condition has never been better than it is today, in spite of warming, or maybe in part, in some cases, because of it. Global crop yields are at all-time record highs since the data began since data collection began in 1961. They've been at all-time record highs in the last 5-10 years. And they claim that climate change is harming crops, is causing widespread crop failures and famine. But where is it? You know, locally, there's probably, you know, certainly cases, but globally, crop yields are higher than ever. Now, some of that, you know, climate skeptics will say that that's due to CO2 fertilization. And some of it is. Even the EPA actually used to have a page before the Biden administration came in that actually admitted that. But you could find it on the web archive. But most of this increase is due to genetic engineering and developing high yield crop varieties, better irrigation, just better farming practices in general is the main culprit here for that. But if climate change is having a net negative impact on it, it's not evident in the data because crop yields have increased despite whatever impacts climate change supposedly has had on crop production and the agricultural industry. You look at the share of the population that's malnourished due to famine or whatever, it's at all-time record lows. You look at life expectancy because of our burning of fossil fuels primarily, which enables everything. It enables the development of life-saving technologies, medical equipment, vaccines. It runs your AC, it runs your heating, your cooling, all of it. Everything, our entire society exists because of all the stuff that we have today exists because of fossil fuels, or just about everything. And so all of this has allowed life expectancy to more than double since the 1850s in every continent on Earth, including even in Africa, where the Greens largely deprived them of access to fossil fuels. And that's a whole other ethical issue. But you look at things like the number of disaster-related deaths. They're down 92% since the 1920s. The number of people dying from meteorological-related disasters, floods, droughts, heat waves, cold waves, floods, fires, all of these things, they're down 92%. Now, a lot of that's because of warning coordination technologies. The Galveston hurricane in 1900 killed 8,000 to 12,000 people. That's because nobody knew what was coming. We have that technology today to warn people in advance. We don't see death tolls of 10,000 people from a weather event anymore. We may see a few hundred, at worst 1,000, you know, maybe over in China or Japan or somewhere where that gets hit by a devastating typhoon, where there's really a high concentrated population, you might see death tolls occasionally top 1,000 for some of these events. But in the United States, you might see even a Category 5 hurricane, you might have maybe 100 deaths at most today than you would have had 30 or 50 to 100 years ago. But either way, they say climate change is killing people. It's not evident. Even if it were, it's not evident in the data. And so the human condition has never been better than it is today. There's no actual relevant data metric that exists that proves that we're in a climate crisis. They say, look at the Arctic, the sea ice melting in the Arctic. Okay, well, how is that bad? Why is that bad? They can't. And what's the correct amount of sea ice that there should be? And why was the Arctic ice free during the summer periodically between 10,000 and 6,000 years ago? And how did that happen? Why is it a crisis now, but it wasn't then? So the climate crisis distinction only exists. They always fixate on global average temperature as if that's the control knob of the human condition and our state of well-being. But there's no indication that global temperature controls the amount of extreme weather or the number of how deadly a storm is. There's no indication that global average temperature really is the control knob of the human condition. Arguably, we could argue if it does, it would be warmer periods that are better. That's why warmer periods have historically been called optimums. But even then, you know, it's not really the control knob of things, especially now with our technologies. We're a very adaptive species. We can mitigate and overcome all sorts of challenges with technologies.
Yeah, is it so bad to live in a world of megafauna, megaflora? Would that be bad?
I don't. Yeah, you look at the, you know, the yeah, we have deforestation is a major issue, for example, but in some areas. But overall, the Earth's actually greener than it was 30, 40 years ago, which a lot of people don't know. And some of that is actually due to CO2 fertilization. Some of it's due to environmental regulations and stuff as well. But, you know, why is that? And even NASA admits that. So why is that a bad thing? Actually, I heard a story recently. They said that trees are bad.
Like, what?
I saw it was something related to climate. I don't remember what the full context was. Oh, it was in relation to the retreating of glacial ice in the polar regions. There was some headline, and I think it might have been based on a new study, and they stated that there's more trees growing in the higher latitudes because of receding sea ice, or it's not sea ice, we're fleeting, receding glaciers. So we have in parts of Canada and Europe, there's more trees. They're farther north, up in Sweden, Norway, you know, for example, Alaska, there's more trees, and that's making Earth a better absorber of radiation because trees don't, I guess, they don't reflect sunlight because they're not like snow. They don't have that albedo, which you talked about at the beginning. And so it actually increases warming. It's like a positive feedback loop. And that, so that it, trees are, the more trees are bad now. So
it's almost like they're trying, they've made a conclusion and they're trying to make any data point towards that conclusion.
Wait, you can look up climate change, and you just type in Google one day if you're just bored, and type in climate change and just let the search results fill out, or just hit the enter button after climate change, and you're going to find a bunch of studies. I saw an article from Fox News, and they said bread causes global warming.
Bread?
Yes.
The yeast is emitting too much.
Yeah, it's insanity, and yet yours and my taxpayer dollars are largely funded, are largely apportioned to the National Science Foundation or other agencies to fund this research, to bankroll these academics to publish this pretty much useless research.
Yeah, and that's...
And it's hard on.
And that's not only is that frustrating, but the more frustrating thing is that all of this attention to this hysteria and catering to the hysterics is really... not only leaked into our economy via increased taxes, whether that's via the Inflation Reduction Act, which Biden overtly admitted was a veiled climate act. He just had to name something else. You look at ESG initiatives at the corporate level, which are failing terribly, which is good to see. Failing incredibly well, actually. Not terribly, they're failing well. And it seems like that trend's out the way, but we've had this distraction and incredible misallocation of capital, particularly over the last two decades due to this problem. That's the frustrating thing, because there are low-hanging fruit that we could, like, I am an environmentalist. I'm a surfer. I'm a big cleaner beach guy. Leave the beach cleaner than when you showed up. Like, my family has a Perky. We drink clean water. We're very health conscious and environmentally conscious in terms of how we treat our environment and what we put in our bodies and things like that. And there's the over indexing on catering to the climate hysterics has really led to a neglect of environmental things that we should be doing but aren't doing because everybody's focused on this broader climate hysteria. And I think this is a good point to bring up something that we didn't touch on, but I think it's very important that we do, which is a great example of this is like urban heat islands. Like, what are some things, what are some of the ramifications of the urban environments that have been built up over the last five decades across the United States and across the world? And like, how is that affecting measurements in particular areas? And going back to clouds and ice being white, like, one low hanging fruit that I've always been passionate about, like, why don't we ever do this? Like, why don't we just all paint our roofs white to have that like reflective thing? Like, there's like low hanging fruits from an environmental, like, if we want to use less electricity, I think we should be as efficient as possible with electricity. I don't think we should be wasteful at all. Like, there's low hanging fruit, like paint your roof white, and your house will be cooler naturally, so you don't have to turn on your AC as much.
I think that they wanted to try that in Los Angeles, and actually, they even went as far as saying they wanted to paint the roads white to do that. I don't know if they've actually done any of that or not, but I thought it was interesting. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea, especially in an urban heat island area where they retain heat. But before I go into that, I actually wanted to elaborate a little on the environmental issue. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this hysteria over climate, that's where most of these, this art, the taxpayer dollar, the research fund goes into is climate research and publishing a lot of these just pretty much useless studies that it's not going to advance science by any measure. These people just seek notoriety and fame, and they want to keep their career. You look at a lot of these people, these scientists, there's no really climate science. In a climate science degree is very a new construct. Most of the big, well-known climate scientists out there, they don't have degrees in climate science. They have degrees in meteorology. They might have degrees in physics. Usually, it's usually physics or mathematics, mathematicians who were unable to find work in their own fields. And they just were not, either somebody was far smarter than they were, or they couldn't advance in mathematics and physics. So they're like, oh, let's go to climate science because it uses physics and it uses math. So a lot of subpar physicists and subpar mathematicians have come into climate science, which historically was a field dominated by geologists and meteorologists. You also see people in data science. Now, climate's a multifaceted issue. It involves a lot of interactions between the Earth system and the atmosphere. It involves components of chemistry and biology and math and data science. It involves all of those things. So you can't just have a climate scientist. You have to have people from all sorts of backgrounds. But it's always funny when you talk to a climate alarmist, like, you're not a climate scientist. Well, most climate scientists are climate scientists by trade. Dr. William Happer is a physicist, but they claim that he's not credible, even though he was a science advisor to Presidents Trump, Bush, H.W. Bush, and then Clinton, until Al Gore had him fired. Bill Happer is a well-known physicist, and he's in recent years focused on climate during his more retired years, a later career. But before that, he was primarily focused on physics. But other scientists Michael Mann, for example, at UPenn, he's a geologist, a mathematician, and a physicist by trade. He has all sorts of degrees. I mean, because kudos to him for doing that education. But Michael Mann is like he is the face of climate science. He is the face of climate science, and he's treated as an authority on it. And I will give him this, rightfully should be, because he's had a lot of research published. And yes, he's known for the hockey stick graph, but he's been successful, and I got to hand it to him. But he's no more qualified to speak about climate change than Dr. William Happer or Dr. Steve Koonin. Both of them are physicists as well. But because they don't go with the strident messaging, they're not considered climate scientists by the activist crowd. But what I wanted to touch on, back to your point about urban heat island effects, really switching gears here. This is a major problem. I mean, when we first started the observational network of temperature monitoring, the COOP stations, which are now integrated into the NOAA United States or NOAA Global Historical Climatology Network daily data set, the GHCND stations, these stations were propped up randomly at random towns across the United States and the world as well, but primarily concentrated in the U.S., most of the data is. They were just there to provide weather information. They weren't supposed to be used for climate monitoring because they're not spatially distributed evenly. And over time, some of these stations have they've had the city built up around them. Some of them were moved to airports, and then eventually the city had grown around the airport, like Las Vegas and Phoenix, for example. Washington, D.C. is another great example. And you look at that, and that has significant impact because most of our temperature data comes from stations that were moved to airports. Now, the reason they were moved to airports in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s is because pilots and air traffic controllers needed real-time weather information on site to have safe landings and safe takeoffs, as well as to divert flights. Hey, the weather conditions here are not ideal for landing. You might want to circle around for a little bit or land at this airport instead. than if weather conditions were unfavorable. So they needed real-time weather information. That's why they removed the airports. These stations were never intended to serve as a network for monitoring global climate. Yet that's what they have become. And because of this, there's a whole host of issues. The computer models try and do a spatial area-weighted mean to account for where they do interpolation, where there's missing data, and that's largely guesswork at best. And once you're outside the United States, this becomes a major, major problem. There's practically no data in South America prior to World War II. There's no data in Africa. Even Africa lacks data today on this. There's no data in Antarctica prior to the 1940s. There's barely any data in the Arctic for any time period. You got a few stations in southern Greenland, a few stations in northern Alaska and Russia, over there in Siberia, but and maybe in Norway, Sweden, Finland. But there's very few stations in a lot of the regions. And so they just use computer models to kind of guess what the temperature is in a lot of places. And another big problem is that a lot of station counts have dropped. A lot of stations have ceased operation. NOAA still reports data for those stations, but they mark that box with an E for estimated. So they don't actually have measurements from a lot of stations, even in the United States. There's been a significant drop in station coverage since the 1990s for the long-term measuring sites. So where those sites are ghost stations, NOAA still reports data, but they just fill it in with an E for estimated because they use computer models to just guess what the temperature was. And if you're off by a degree or two, that has significant impacts. This happens at a lot of stations and you have a warm bias to it, which tends to be the case, you're going to get an artificial warming trend. And they also know we'll also adjust the data for the supposed time of observation bias. And I've seen conflicting things on that. I see legitimate reasons for it. And I also see why it's suspicious. Essentially, the time of observation bias is what happens with that is when, if you take the temperature measurement once per day at 3 p.m. and you look at the maximum temperature on the min-max thermometer, and you look at it at, say, 3 p.m. one day, and it's 95 degrees, and then you reset it. Well, say the cold front comes through at 6 p.m., and then the temperature falls to 45 degrees by the next day. Well, you go out at 3 p.m. again, maybe the temperature might have only got 60, but the thermometer will read 95 degrees because you reset it at 3 p.m. rather than before you went to bed. So, and if you do the opposite in the morning, you have the same effects, but it actually induces the cooling bias for overnight loads. But NOAA also mandated that people measure prior to the 1970s, and they had they changed to more automated weather stations rather than min-max thermometers. NOAA mandated that they had to report once at 3 p.m.
And the hottest point of the day.
Yeah, well, the min-max thermometer actually measures the temperature. It actually registers, it locks in what the high. So if you go out, if you reset the thermometer 7 a.m. and it's at 45 degrees, and you go out in the afternoon and it's, you go out at say 9 a.m. and it's 7 or it's 54 degrees. The thermometer will read 54, but say at 10 a.m. it drops to 53. The max thermometer will still say, there's two thermometers. It's a min-max thermometer. They measure the daily maximum and minimum, so you don't have to monitor it every hour. So it locks in what the high temperature was. So if it goes down, the temperature goes down to, say, 53, it's still going to register 54 until the temperature goes up again. So then it goes to 55, and then it locks in. So if you go away for a few hours, you can come back and say, oh, that was the high temperature for that 24-hour period. But NOAA mandated and required people measure only once per day at about 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And the station observers weren't allowed to reset the thermometer more than once per day, and they weren't able to reset it at a certain time to ensure that the reading. So they claim that hot days were overcounted back then. So you might have had two 95 degree days, and so that's why they adjust temperatures in the past downward and present temperatures upward. And that's how they get this big warming trend that doesn't exist in the raw data. The problem I had with that, though, was that this was obviously a major problem. Anybody that operated a min-max thermometer would be able to notice that this was a problem right away within a few days of using it. So just because they weren't allowed to reset the thermometer you know, at a certain time, or like they're only allowed to reset at a certain time and once per day prior to the 1970s when they were replaced with automated weather service stations. They doesn't mean that they did. They followed those guidelines. They were, nobody was able to, you know, go and see, oh, well, if they didn't have security cameras, they weren't monitoring, oh, well, he reset the thermometer. They didn't have no way of knowing whether they reset a min-max thermometer. So people, if they figured it out, they might have just done it against the guidelines. I don't know. There's nobody knows. The other thing with this is that they claim that, you might have had the 95-degree day and then you double-counted it because you reset it at 3 p.m., but the temperature the next day was only up to 65, but you reset it at 3 p.m. and it still registered 95 degrees for the high because you reset it in the afternoon rather than in the morning as well. The problem with that is that if you actually look at individual state, and I've done a lot of this for just my own analyses, if you actually look at an individual weather station, you look at this, you pull up the monthly data for the daily maximum and daily minimum, seldom will you ever see two back-to-back 95-degree days. So that to me, that indicates that the station operators knew what they were doing and maybe they didn't necessarily follow NOAA guidelines. I don't know. And I see both cases for why you need those adjustments. It's a legitimate concern, but I'm not convinced it was actually a problem.
This sounds completely stupid to me. Like, and it's probably because I'm ignorant and don't know. Like, why can't they just have these thermometers like every 5 minutes send temperature data? Like, why do you have to do?
Well, back before the 1970s, they didn't have the ability to do this. Yeah. They had just mercury and glass thermometers. Now we have automated weather stations, so it does send data like every. It's either every, I don't know what it is, whether it's every 5 minutes or not.
Okay.
The station at my university is every 5 minutes we provide observations, but some of the NOAA ones maybe only report an hour. I don't know.
So you're talking about what it was like decades ago?
Yeah, decades ago. Yes, they had mercury in glass. Min max thermometers. They were two side by side and you had to reset them. So it would record the daily minimum and it would lock in what the minimum temperature was. So even if the temperature changed, it would still show you what the minimum was. Same thing with the high. But the problem is that if you had just looking at the maximum temperature, which is the bigger concern here, if you reset it at three, if it reached 95 degrees, say on this afternoon, and the maximum thermometer recorded it registered 95 degrees. If you go out and reset the thermometer and this is back in the old days, at 3 p.m., and you go just to go about your day, the max thermometer will probably read 95 degrees for the next 24-hour observation period for the following day, which is not accurate, especially if you have a cold front come through and it drops the temperature by 30 degrees. You go out at 3 p.m. the next day, it'll say the maximum for tomorrow's.
Yeah, so if you
tomorrow
at 3 p.m. on Monday, you flip it off and on, it's going to be 95 degrees. Then you go to 3 p.m. the next day, you have this cold front, like the max, and it drops to 70 degrees. Like, even though,
but you still have a 95 degree reading. Yep.
Yeah. And so, like, 12 a.m. Tuesday to 3 p.m., the max high is probably something like 75, and it doesn't register that. Yeah.
Yeah. It registers too high because you reset it before the cold front came through. So a lot of these things, it is a legitimate concern. And so that's the reason that they claim that they need to adjust the data down in the past that you get this larger warming trend. But I'm not necessarily convinced. I haven't seen enough compelling evidence to suggest that this was actually, even though NOAA required people and we were allowed to only do it at 3 p.m. once per day, you know, or in the morning, you could do it in the morning or you could do it in the evening. I think it was, you could either do it at like 7 a.m. or 3. You could just do it once per day at one time or the other. I don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that's what the mandate was. But that doesn't mean they actually followed those guidelines, because in 1930, they didn't have security cameras to see, make sure that you're using the equipment properly. But any station observer that has an IQ higher than a turnip would understand that, okay, this is a problem. And maybe, yeah, NOAA tells me that I'm not allowed to reset the thermometer twice per day, but I'm going to do it anyway. So again, we don't know what people did. So it's largely just an assumption, you know, but if it were a real problem, then it would justify why they adjust the past down and then make the present more. But the problem with this pairwise homogenization is that it tries to eliminate urban heat island effects, but it doesn't really do a good job at that. And They try to account for station moves, because if you move a station, a change in elevation can make a big difference in what the temperature is, because typically temperature decreases. So there's a lot of problems with this entire temperature network long term, especially on a worldwide basis. So you have to have huge error bars in your global temperature data sets, and they don't do that. Yes, is the Earth overall warmer than it was? Probably even in the 1930s, yes. But again, there's a huge range of uncertainty. And they just make these arbitrary adjustments. Their documentation is not well documented. You start asking questions about it, like, oh, why did you adjust this temperature down this much by for that month for that station, and you only did it for this amount for the next month? And then you start asking for details on it, and people at like NASA GISS, NASA GIS, Goddard Institute for Space Studies, they get kind of angry when you start pressing them about that. Now, I'm not accusing them of anything, but what they're doing could be certainly legitimate and necessary. But I just find it suspicious that they don't really want to answer questions when you press them.
Well, that begs the question. Do you think they have an agenda? You think this is pure hubris, people just being like, I'm the scientist here, what I say goes? Or do you think there is an agenda? Because if you look at the ramifications of the propaganda around cataclysmic climate change, it, as we discussed briefly earlier, it does have material effects on what humans are allowed to do in terms of building energy infrastructure, certain types of combustion engines and cars. Now you have like LEED certification with housing. There's talk of taking natural gas stoves out of houses in California and apartment buildings in New York. Like, this has real effects on the quality of life and access to goods and services throughout the economy. And I've been of the purview that they're like, they don't really care about the climate at the end of the day. They need to force this data and fear monger people into acting a certain way so that they can control them more granularly. Energy is the most important tool that we use in the world. It allows us to be more productive. And if you decrease the quality of the energy utilization tools that people can use, then you can more easily control them. And then conversations about carbon credits and social credit scores and central bank digital currencies, and you can see how it could all fit together, where they're able to fearmonger and cater to people's emotions to get them to do certain things, then cattle herd them into this dystopian digital future, and then have more control over what humans can do.
Yeah, you know, I think that and you mentioned earlier that about how you're an environmentalist, right? And a real environmentalist is somebody who actually legitimately cares about the environment. Somebody that's out there cleaning up plastic out of the streams and rivers off the beach, you know, in your case, people that are making, you know, health conscious, environmentally conscious decisions with, you know, making sure they're not littering, making sure that they're, you know, using, you know, not wasting water and stuff. The fake environmentalists are the people out there with picket signs protesting, but they don't know what they're protesting for. They're the people that are sitting online lecturing you about how you need to reduce your carbon footprint, and how the crypto bros need to reduce their carbon footprint, but they're the ones on their online throwing a, you know, temper tantrum, which also has a large carbon footprint. None of these people want to give up the lifestyles that they want to force. They don't want to give up their comfortable lifestyles. They don't want to live the net zero lifestyle that they want to force on everybody else. And when it comes to the whole, whether or not there's an agenda behind all of this, you know, the United Nations Environment Program in the 1980s, they saw global warming as this emerging scientific issue. Now, again, it has a legitimate scientific basis, which we discussed at the beginning of this podcast, this interview. There is a legitimate scientific basis behind global warming. The problem is that IPCC has a bunch of unelected bureaucrats who they have a globalist policy agenda. They want to influence policy, energy policy, all sorts of policy, foreign policy, diplomacy, everything from a centralized point of view. They want to have kind of a one world government. They have a very anti-capitalist anti-corporation motive behind a lot of their policies. And they saw climate change as a perfect scientific issue where, oh, well, this is a way that we can start regulating private companies. If we can put together a panel of scientific experts, scientists, to look for evidence of human-induced climate change, and we can then, if through fossil fuel emissions, we can tie carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel burning to climate change to global warming, and then we can convey this as problematic, as bad, then we can they can use that as a crutch, use the scientific community as a crutch to justify regulating oil companies, regulating energy companies, regulating the supply, just the supply and distribution of energy. And then they now, you know, talk about how we need to change our diets to vegan. We need to eat lab-grown meat. We need to abandon steak and hamburgers because the Big Mac is causing global warming. They use, and from, you know, it has a high carbon footprint. They use this as justification to regulate than the food industry. They want to have government control over private corporations, private enterprises. They don't want individual liberty, individual personal choice. They want government regulated energy. They can tell you how much energy you can use. It's a part of the whole carbon credit system that they want to implement. You're given a monthly allowance for how much CO2 you're allowed to emit through how much you drive, where you can drive, how much you can travel by airplane, what food you can eat. I mean, in Canada, in parts of Canada, I think they even tax you on, like, food. They have a carbon tax on food, like pizza. And it's just a way to regulate. So if you go over that, if you have a carbon credit system, you go over your monthly allowance, then you can buy more carbon credits, and you can pollute more, quote unquote. And it's a way to, and if you don't buy more, then they want to make all the currency digital. They want to have a cashless society so that if you go over your carbon credit limit, for example, then you can't, and you don't buy more credits, don't pay the government money. Hey, I sinned. I had a carbon sin. Give me some credits. I'll pay you to forgive my carbon sins. Then they can use that as they can shut off your credit card and your debit card. They shut off any financial transactions, so you can't purchase anything. They want to control the type of stove you can have in your house, the type of your refrigerator, heat pump. They want to control. They want to get rid of hot water heaters. I just saw an article on that. They want to regulate. They want to micromanage everything about your life. So the United Nations, this is their entire agenda. They're a globalist organization. That's their purpose. And they saw climate change as a way to kind of jog the policy cart along. If we can tie the observed warming trend somehow to carbon dioxide emissions, then we can regulate energy, and that gives us control over everything else, over everybody. And it's a very anti-capitalist organization. So when this came along, they developed the IPCC in 1990. That's when the first assessment report came out. They got a bunch of experts together to conduct science, to investigate, and specifically, even in the founding documents, the IPCC specifically states that they are tasked scientists with looking for evidence of human-caused climate change and its impacts on society. So while they do make mention of it, and even in detail, in some cases, natural variability, that's not their focus. They're not tasking scientists to write the physical science basis. They have the WG1 report, which is the most credible part of the report, because you have the adaptation mitigation policy report. You have the WD2 and WG3 reports as well. They don't task scientists with looking for benefits of global warming or natural causes of global warming. They're specifically supposed to find evidence of that warming is man-made due to fossil fuel emissions and that it's bad and harmful to society. And then they kind of can have a little bit of leeway on policy solutions that are quote-unquote nonpartisan. And the IPCC was specifically founded to build the case from a scientific community to regulate emissions. There was, and if you say that, you're considered a conspiracy theorist, but which is nonsense. There's been bureaucrats who worked for the United Nations who have admitted that to people like Dr. Roy Spencer, one of the people who was in charge, one of the key bureaucrats that was involved in the first organizational structure of the IPCC, actually admitted to Dr. Roy Spencer himself in private conversation that that was the reason the IPCC was created by the United Nations Environment Program, was to do that very specific thing. So there was no, and if somebody comes back at you with, well, you're a conspiracy theorist for saying that, because the climate scientists who are in bed with this report, these reports, it'll be wrong. The physical science basis is okay. It has an okay, fairly balanced assessment of the issue without being alarmist in tone or partisan. There's still issues to pick with it, which I discussed earlier with the hurricane proportions. But a good comeback, a good follow-up to when you're accused of that, being a conspiracy theorist for suggesting that, is why would there be a need for an IPCC? We already have the Met Office in the UK, the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia. We have the Danish Meteorological Institute. You have NOAA. You have NASA. You have the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and all these organizations in the United States. And you have academics and universities all around the world that are looking at this issue. They can call each other on the phone. They can go buy a plane ticket, or they can travel. They can travel and meet up together to collaborate. You don't need a United Nations, a bureaucratically, politically driven scientific working group to investigate climate change. There's no need for an IPCC when you have all these other organizations working on it already and have been for decades. So the IPCC is purely for political motivations and with anti-capitalist undertones.
Yeah, it's a communist Marxist movement. They want to control you. And it's so do you think the pendulum swinging there? Do you think enough people are getting are becoming wise to the manipulation and the trickery afoot? Like, what's your experience like going through the meteorology program in college? So I studied economics in college, and I was indoctrinated with the Keynesian view of the world later. I knew enough about the Austrian view to sort of check what I was being taught versus what I believed to be true. Is that a similar experience in climate related degrees these days for you?
Thankfully, in my atmospheric science program, there's not a whole lot of discussion around climate change. And my professors that I have do not necessarily agree with me on everything. Some of them don't agree with me on just about anything that I say regarding the issue. Some of them probably agree with some things I say or don't agree, but none of them are really engaged in, you know, cancel culture. They understand that my position that I have is scientifically defensible, and they understand that I back my statements up with evidence and data, and that I'm not just talking out of my rear. And there's been people, attacks from outside, and I'm trying to get me kicked out of the program, but my professors value freedom of speech, and they have been, most of them have been a safe haven for me, and they've defended my right to free speech, and they encourage rigorous but civil scientific debate and dialogue. But because it's a meteorology program, we're more focused on just the weather and weather forecasting and the dynamics that govern the atmosphere, which is critical to climate by extension. We don't focus as much on climate. It's not a climate-focused degree. It's more weather-focused degree. But you can't understand climate if you don't understand the weather. I think that's the first part. And then you also have to understand the oceans. That's why oceanography, taking courses in that, which I wish I had done, is also essential. So that is one regret I have about my college experience, is that I didn't have time, or I just didn't take oceanography courses, because that's also very important. Then you have the geology aspects and stuff. As far as the student body goes, a lot of the students agree with what I say, you know, in private. Some still like my posts on social media. But a lot of them agree with me. Not all of them do, but for the most part, everybody's just kind of civil about it, where we find other stuff to talk about. It's actually, I don't know how it is at other universities. I'm sure it's worse, but where I go, it's actually been pretty, it's been actually, for the most part, a smooth ride with me being an outspoken voice that doesn't toe the line of some of the mainstream narrative aspects of the issue. Another thing I want to point out is that, as long as you can defend your position scientifically with data and evidence, then you're okay. We do take a course in climate dynamics. Actually, I'm taking that right now. And my professor is fantastic. She's wonderful. She doesn't necessarily share some of my views on things, but I've given presentations and, I get hundreds on them. And she gives a very fair and balanced kind of take on this. It's just what is the data show? And you can quibble about data methods and why this data set is misleading or something like that, but there's not really an agenda behind it. It's just educating the students as students should be educated, not indoctrinated. So I cannot, for me personally, I cannot speak highly enough of my program. I love my professors. I love my peers. Everybody's fantastic. It's probably not the case everywhere in every academic institution. I know it's certainly not for faculty, but at least for me, it's been okay.
That's very encouraging to hear. That's what you want: rigorous academic debate backed by facts and competing views, putting them out there. And that's why I really, outside of the universe, that's why I've been a fan of yours for years on Twitter, because you get into it with a bunch of the hysterics. And as you mentioned, they come after you personally and try to, affect your personal life. So what's that been like, developing this social media presence and putting up with all these hysterics from around the world?
I have a lot of people there's certain individuals out there who have a weird obsession with me. I don't know what it is. It's like they are determined to bring me down, but I'm not worried about them. I'm not worried about my career. I'm not worried about anything. I have everything lined up that I need to once I graduate. And in a lot of cases, it's a better job than you could probably get. A lot of traditional meteorology. I always told people, people like, they expect me, the people that hate me, they want me to, they think that in order to have a legitimate job, I need to go into academia or I need to go into the government or operational forecasting somewhere. But not everybody who goes through meteorology does that. Some of my friends, one of my buddies is still working at Walmart. He's just having a hard time finding a job. I know people that are becoming pilots, that have graduated with meteorology degrees. So they're becoming air traffic controllers. But they're doing aviation stuff. They're not necessarily doing meteorology, or they're not doing necessarily the traditional meteorology job. I told people, in my followers a long time ago, that I wanted to do something. I wanted to stand out. I wanted to do my own thing. Because you cannot be a leader if you are a follower and you're doing what everybody else is doing. I've taken a lot of risks doing what I'm in, being outspoken the way I am, but I've been able to build up a platform where I'm kind of immune from, being kind of, I guess, quote unquote, canceled. Because I have such a large following, I've cultivated a large fan base. I get a lot of interview requests, a lot of media coverage, in the Blaze. Sometimes I get, I actually have an article for the Daily Wire I'm writing coming out soon. I got celebrities even that follow me, Larry the Cable Guy and Dean Cain. And so that's pretty cool. Rob Schneider has even retweeted me a couple of times. And I got congressmen who follow me and other really esteemed scientists that love what I do in private. I get emails all the time from people at NOAA, people at other academic institutions, other universities, a lot of TV meteorologists who on the down low love what I do and encourage me to keep up. And while I might have closed, I certainly have shut doors on some traditional meteorology jobs, I want to do what I want to do. I want to do things my way and my way only. And I want to be able to be a leader and carve my own path. I don't want to do it. I don't want to be a cookie cutter. So you can criticize me and say that I don't have a legitimate, I won't have a legitimate job in meteorology, but I don't care. I probably what I'm doing will probably be a better paying job than most of the field. And I'll have fun doing what I'm doing now with that, but, you know, getting paid full time for it. And the people that I work with that I've done my internship with, which is the full-time job offer, it's a great working environment. I love everybody. We're fantastic. We have fun. It's not actually, it's just an extension of what I do for my free time, basically. But you get paid to do it. And so I'm not worried about blowback from people in the outside world. They can hate me all they want, but I'm not going to be liked by everybody. I don't seek to be liked by everybody. I have 82,000 people on Twitter who love what I do and 17,000 people on Facebook who love what I do. And to me, it's the fans and what they, you know, their input that matters more to me than my critics, just like in the music industry. The music critics, the credentialed music critics are always trying to bring upcoming and even established artists down for the music that they put out. They say, well, that's, you can't put out that music, or that music's not, you know, a case like Travis Tritt, country music icon Travis Tritt. He was considered too outlaw country for the 90s, but he did things his way and his way only, which is advice Waylon Jennings gave him. And he carved his own path, ended up having many, many hits and won a lot of awards, and it was still pretty relevant today. You know, it's by touring standards and social media presence. And people told him, the critics told him that you can't do this outlaw country, you don't fit in. But he carved his own path. People tell me that I would never go to college, that I would never be accepted into a program, that I would never graduate, that I'd never find a job. And yet time and time again, my critics are being proven. So I like doing things my way, and I don't care what my haters say. To me, it's my fans that I've cultivated. Their input matters more to me. And I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing just because somebody hates me online.
Yeah. That's the way to do it. Be a leader, not a follower. That's the it's the one line my mom beat into our heads growing up. And that's the thing, you'll find the followers, or that's what the critics are typically, is followers who are a bit personally pissed off that they didn't have the courage to lead, and they got to drag the leaders down. Yep, exactly. Success.
Exactly. And, that's a good advice that your mom gave you. That's really much the best advice you can give someone. I tell the freshman meteorology majors that come into my program that they say, what's the best advice? They say, should I get involved with this club or that club? I said, yeah, you should do that. But if you want to really stand out, do your own thing.
Oh. And so what is your own thing post-graduation? Do you know yet? Or
I have this organization. I did an internship with them. CFACT, a Committee for Constructive Tomorrow. Mark Morano, he's a really well-known guy. He's kind of our key media person. And I got a full-time job offer with them. And basically, we're sort of like Greenpeace, but we actually take the environment seriously. And we actually advocate for preserving the natural world as it is and not littering it with solar and wind farms. We're fans of nuclear power. We want to see more nuclear power because that's a great clean energy source. That's essentially, you know, quote unquote, carbon free. And so we advocate for those solutions, and we advocate for free market solutions, less government control over our lives. And they like my data analysis. And so they want me to come on board full time. I might decide to pursue grad school first. But we'll cross that bridge when we get there. I don't know what I'm doing yet, 100%, but, you know, right out of college. But we'll figure it out. And several other organizations have asked me, they want me for similar things. Several prominent organizations that want me, you know, to do very similar things. So we'll see what happens, but that's kind of my goals right now. But nothing set in stone just yet.
Yeah, I don't think you have anything to worry about, Chris. I think you're blazing your own path. And
the thing is, all these people that are hating me from inside my own industry, you know, most of them are people outside the industry. They're not in meteorology, but some of them are. Why would I want to work with people who hate me? You know, I'll go where I'm needed and where I can be effective and have fun with it. So I'm not concerned. Yeah. The haters are going to hate, and they can hate. I'm still going to be here living rent-free in their heads.
Yeah. Well, keep having fun, because it's bring a lot of fun to my life, too. I love your love your takes on the squabbles you get into.
You have to be – I tell people that you have to go on the offense.
Yep.
You cannot – the people – every time skeptics or lukewarmers or whoever, people on Team Reality take defense. They box themselves into a corner, kind of like Trump did last night on the debate. He just boxed himself into a corner. Let him get under their skin. If you fight fire with fire and you go back at them and mock them and laugh at them for just their dumb arguments, then you make them madder than a midget in a yo-yo contest. Playing offense is how you win. And that's the messaging that I want to give out to people that are on our side and us that are on Team Reality. Play offense.
Yeah. No, that's it was funny because my foray into the Bitcoin mining industry was off-grid. Oil and gas mining. We did flare mitigation on upstream oil and gas well pads. And it was funny straying into that industry just because they had cheap energy to mine Bitcoin with. And getting to know people in the oil and gas industry, they were dejected after decades of getting beaten down by climate hysterics, ESG mandates, and what have you. And that's something we've been fighting. I mean, Bitcoiners, I've been in Bitcoin for 11 years now, and we're trying to replace the reserve currency of the world with this crazy digital internet money. So we've been getting made fun of and cast aside for almost two decades now. And I think that's one thing we were able to bring to the oil and gas industry, Great American Mining specifically, was like, we've been through this. When it comes to Bitcoin versus fiat or gold, whatever, you got to own the frame. Do not work within the frame that these hysterics put in front of you, whether they're fiat hysterics or climate hysterics. Like, own the frame. Energy is good. We need to be as energy efficient as possible. The world is not going to end because the weather's changing or it's getting hotter. It's, as you mentioned, could be a good thing for us. Like, we need to make sure that humans are flourishing, that we're utilizing all the resources at our fingertips as best as we can. And we need to get these kleptocratic central planners out of the way. Own the frame. Don't let people box you into a corner. Like you said, just be confident, and ridicule is effective. It does get under people's skin. Like you said, Kamala, yep. Trump had the ability to come down with a hammer, and all Kamala had to do is say, yeah, people are leaving your rallies. And he got all distracted and pissed off. She owned the frame in that and beat him in that particular point. And that's what we got to do, whether it's like Bitcoin, what you're doing in the realm of climate, own the frame, be confident. We have data, we have truth on our side at the end of the day.
Absolutely agree.
Any final thoughts you want to wrap up with? It seems like, are you in a restaurant? It seems like it's getting busy in there.
I'm at a hotel.
Hotel, yeah.
If you're listening and you want to follow me on my Twitter page, it's Chris Marsh WX, and you can find me there. That's where I usually post. Also on Facebook, same username, Chris Marsh. It's Chris Marsh Weather. You can also find my blog, chrismarchweather.com, and that's where I do a lot of my in-depth blog postings. It's very time-consuming because I don't have a whole lot of time to do them anymore with college, but when I get the time, they're really good articles I've done on hurricanes and tornadoes and fires and ice melt and stuff like that. So I encourage people to go check out chrismartsweather.com. And also visit where I'm doing my internship this summer. Visit us on the web at cfact.org. That is cfact.org.
Awesome. Chris, keep crushing it, brother. Hopefully we can do this again at some point in the future, maybe in person.
Yeah, we'd love to do it in person. I'll try and get down there to Texas, and we'll do this some other time. But thanks for having me on. It was really fun doing this and a really good interview. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, anytime, dude. Peace and love, freaks.